And I remember there was a white man. He had on a straw hat and suspenders. And this man comes up to us and he said, "Hi, where y'all from?" And we said, "We were from Boston." "Well, why don't y'all go back where you come from? We don't need you messing in our business here."
Welcome to Cambridge Forum, discussing Witness to History, Remembering Freedom Summer with Jack Landrone. I am Millie Ron. I'm a folklorist and oral historian. Many of you know Jack as a folk singer and songwriter, known in the old days as Jackie Washington. But today we're going to hear about Jack Landrone, the witness to history. Jack found a new direction when he traveled to Mississippi in 1964. Many folk songers went south to sing for rallies, including many right here from Cambridge. But he chose to stay in Mississippi, joining the movement and helping to form the Free Southern Theater, with which he toured as an actor. So take us back to 1964, 50 years ago, and how you came to leave Boston for Mississippi.
I was a folk singer. I was a folk singer, I think by accident. In my family, a Puerto Rican family living in Roxbury, we sang aguinaldos and decimas and stuff around Christmas time. Also, I lived in a neighborhood which you walked down one of the main streets, Humboldt Avenue, and you would see Clara Ward and the Ward Singers being advertised, or you'd see rhythm and blues shows, which is what rock, I think, was called then. Johnny Ace, the Midnighters, Sonny Till. So I knew all the kind of music that the white kids in Harvard Square and other places or other gathering points, I knew all the music that they thought was folksy or ethnic or something. I knew that it was just music. So I could get a job singing music. A call was put out for self-contained acts to go to Mississippi because there were more black people than white people in Mississippi, and if they would register to vote, maybe you could turn things around. Now, there were deterrents. There was the Ku Klux Klan and the White Citizens Council, and my favorite was the Society for the Preservation of the White Race. And I always used to joke that white people didn't have much confidence in their genes because they had to preserve the white race. But I would play at Club 47. It was at 47 Mount Auburn Street. And then there was some kind of beef about the rent. I don't know what it was. And they moved, finally, to 47 Palmer Street, where they sort of still are. It's now called Passim, but it's Club 47 is the... wouldn't you say that's the rallying cry? All of my audiences were white kids from college and whatnot, many of them from families with some bread. They had, you know, but I, as I want to do, I said when I was going to go to Mississippi, "Well, going to Mississippi, anybody want to join me? Come see me after the show." And there were, I guess I had 4 black kids that followed me would come to the club. And one of them, whose name is now Mustafa Halak, but was Roger Johnson, he said, "I'll go with you." It was wonderful. Okay. Because when you're younger, a lot of things are exciting, and you disguise the fact that you might be a little bit frightened anyway, but it's an adventure. Ooh, ha, 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 ha. A lot of things that I did then I wouldn't do now. Of course, a lot of things I can't do that I did back then, but that's another story. And we drove to Mississippi. It was a different culture that I found when I got to Mississippi. First of all, I loved it. The Southern thing is like that politeness that people have. It wasn't like Roxbury. And it was exciting. But when we went into town, the headquarters of the Council of Federated Organizations, which is where we reported, when we got in Jackson, Mississippi, was on Lynch Street. Gave you pause. But then we decided we would, you know, we'd get something. We went into town and we got planters' hats. We had these straw hats and we bent them up, and then blue jeans and work shirt like Pete Seeger wore. And we were pretty things. And I remember there was a white man from Central Casting, it looked like. He had on a straw hat and suspenders. And this man comes up to us and he said, "Hi." "Hello." Small talk. And then he said, "Where y'all from?" And we said, we were from Boston. "Well, why don't y'all go back where you come from? We don't need you messing in our business here." And he had been so nice, we got into a conversation with him quite easily. But like realized that, hey, we might meet some people who were a little bit more energetic in there telling us to go on back where we came from. What we did was there were people who would volunteer to house the workers, which was, I won't say culture shock, but certainly weird. A place I stayed in with a Teague family, a large family, and they were farmers. They didn't have air conditioning, so in the evening it was warm. After dishes were done or whatever, you sit on the porch, and there were a collection of rocking chairs, and you sit up there and, you know, chit-chat. And people going by, whether you knew them or not, how do? And I felt that was so, that's great, you know, people talk to you. Isn't this lovely? This particular night, the Ku Klux Klan had a parade through the neighborhood, to this black neighborhood. And they were dressed in these outfits, the hooded outfit, but the hood didn't cover the face. There was a little like a visor thing, but the pointed hat, and some of them were, they weren't all white, the robes. Just want to be clear. And they were, some were green satin, and there was a black satin. They had these sharp noses and you know, stern faces, and then they had sparklers, you know, like you get on 4th of July. Well, they were people were carrying them in the parade, or they were stuck in the car, and these people looked so ridiculous to me. So I'm sitting there with the Teague family, and they passed by, and the neighborhood was watching this parade, and it was silent. But I'm looking at this thing, and I go, "Whoa!" Mr. Teague said, "Shut up." It wasn't funny. It was serious. But when you see something that is so very different from anything you've known, surely I knew something about difficulties that you might have being non-white in the world at that time. But it was never treated the way I saw there in Mississippi. It was just, is this really happening? And it was funny. Mr. Teague, I probably saved me by letting me know that might look silly to you, but this is serious. At that time, there were three volunteers that had been abducted and weren't yet found. Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. They were later found. It seems like Mississippi is fertile, because they have all these places where things are grown, overgrown and everything. It's very easy to hide a body. Swamp stuff, I don't know. And I knew that these workers were missing. Everybody was talking about it. But there's something about the whole experience that was, and my youth, that made it exciting and not scary. Didn't get scary to me until Fredericksburg, where I was staying in a house where I taught kids things, freedom schools, they call them. It was at the top of a hill. Here's the, like an old plantation house, you know, the antebellum, whatever that is, up at the top of this hill. And then the hill went down to the street, which it was a two hills meeting. And somebody drove a car up this hill, stopped the car, got out, and looked up at the house in which we were staying and took a rifle and shot at it. bang, bang, bang. And we were laughing. We said, ooh, 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 we're ducking down. But we were scared to death. It was a gun. Somebody shooting at us. And although we were laughing at the excitement of it, I think it was nervous laughter. Because many, I wasn't the only one that hadn't seen anything like this. Am I rambling? I mean,
no.
Get me started. I mean, I'm just trying to remember. I didn't prepare any remarks. So many experiences I had that helped me address life. You know, when you have things that just are instructive to you and it changes the youthful devil-may-care attitude you may have. I got it in Mississippi. It was a nerve-wracking time at the same time that it was fun. It was a constant surprise to me, things that would happen. I think that in every bad thing, there's something good if you can dig it out and learn from it. And I was able to do that. Being in Mississippi, I saw hatred up close and saw how, in many cases, stupid it was, how mindless it was, how necessary it was, because no matter how poor and beat down some of these white folks were, they were better than a nigger. And I was part of a group that were there to take that away from them. This is something that's, if you get in the right frame of mind, these were desperate people. We went to a church where they had bombed four little girls in, you remember that? Is it Alabama?
Birmingham. Yep.
So one of the things, I was to give a concert in this place, and as I told you, the minister gets up and talks first. And people were on edge. They were killed. They were killed. And the minister got up and spoke. That's another thing. I digress for a minute. The way you do in Protestant churches, black Protestant church, the speeches are deep. They're wonderful. So this guy, minister, got up, and by way of trying to bolster the people's courage or whatnot, he gave a little talk. It wasn't a sermon. It was just a little talk to tell why I was there. And the talk he gave consisted of one sentence. A mule kicks hardest before he dies. I said, a mule kicks hardest before he dies. A mule kicks hardest before he dies. A mule kicks hardest before he dies. Every time he said that sentence, he said it a different way. You know, a couple of minutes, people say, yeah, yeah, give me that paper, I'll sign. It was just wonderful oratory that is born of a tradition that was very much alive there in Mississippi, as in other parts of the South. This was ever so exciting to me. I had four of us rented a house in Tougaloo, Mississippi. And we would joke that Tougaloo sounds like something you say when you're leaving a place. Tougaloo! But anyway, they had a field. There was a field on either side of the house. On to my left when I walk out the door, they set up a tent for a revival meeting. And sitting at home at night, I heard them singing. All them women sang like Aretha Franklin. They sang beautifully. I mean, everybody had a wonderful voice. And the way they do it in those churches is if you have a favorite hymn, you ask for it to be sung, and you can lead the hymn. So it's like, it's like a record, you know, there's the lead voice, and then there's people doing in the back. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful stuff. Now, I asked if I was rambling because I'm not telling this in chronological order. I'm just talking about things that impressed me in answer to your question. And going into Mississippi and seeing segregation and we hate you, we're going to lynch you, or whatever that is, up close, as opposed to reading it in a magazine or something, it's unreal. I felt that a lot of the American black kids that were there, they knew what that was about in a different way than I knew what it was about. As what I told you before about laughing at the Klan, it was silly, but it wasn't silly to a lot of people because they knew what it was. So it was very much an education for me, and it shapes who I am today.
Now you cross paths with Dr. King in Mississippi. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Vicksburg. And every now and then, Dr. King would come to Mississippi to help with the voter registration because he's a great orator and all that sort of thing. He was famous. And so, and we called him the Lord. Oh, the Lord coming. And so that was Dr. King. And we're in Vicksburg outside this church. Big crowd. We're all waiting for Dr. King and Dr. Abernathy to show up. And Roger and I were there. He was then Roger. I told you he's Mustafa now. So, okay. The car pulls up. And murmur. Oh, isn't it wonderful? Roger says, come on, man. What? Come on. And I followed Roger. We were wearing our little costume that I described earlier. And he walked up to the car, put his hand on the handle, opened the door and said, good evening, sir. You about ready? Oh, we're just about as ready as we're going to be, says Dr. King. And he gets out the car. Abernathy gets out the car. And Roger starts walking up the, and I'm walking on, he's on the right and I was on the left, watching Roger to see what I'm supposed to do. And we walked up to the front of the church. And when we got to the chancel, Roger went to his side and I went to my side. And we stood there at parade rest. And Dr. King and Dr. Abernathy after the resident minister gave his little talk, whatever, they gave their speeches. And when they finished, Dr. King came over to me and shook my hand and thanked me. And he went over. They went over to Roger. Both of them went over to Roger and thanked him. And then Roger and I walked down the aisle and led back to the car. So I know Dr. King, right? So then, I was a member. I got to be a member of the Free Southern Theater, and we presented we had a production of In White America, and that was it's a theater piece that is made up of quotes from magazines or speeches or whatever. And Dr. King saw it, and he complimented me. My role was to come out in my outfit. Let's take a moment here. I was sharp, and I walked out there. I had this hat and this thing, and my guitar slung over my back. And I would walk on. Now, this is the rehearsal. I would come out and say, good evening. Tonight we're going to see a play. It's a play about us. Not as we are, but as we must be. And then I would take the guitar out from around my back and start strumming, oh, freedom, oh, freedom. And then the other actors would stand up in the places they were sitting in the audience, and they would come up to the stage, and we would do the show. So that's what we rehearsed. The first place we got, I'm the first person on the stage, right? And I came out with my little outfit so full of myself. And I said, good evening. And everybody said, how do? Good evening. I said, whoa. Tonight we're going to see a play. Mm-hmm, that's right. It's a play about us. Well, go ahead, son. Take your time. I said, why are they talking to me? I'm up here. I'm doing this here. What? But after a while, I liked the amens and things you get because I'll let you know how you were doing. To wit, another one of the speeches was from Marcus Garvey, who was a black nationalist. And his speech was, we are too great and powerful a people to grovel in the white man's oppressive dust. No more sycophantic begging and pleading. No more begging for crumbs that fall from the table. The time will come, and it won't be long, when the command will be given, come home, home to Africa. That's the rehearsal. Anyway, this experience led to Roger was in jail. He'd gotten himself arrested. And I was a go-to guy. And I became a personal assistant to Dr. King. I tell everyone I was a personal assistant to Dr. King because I was. I travel around and I would do things. But what I really was, I was a gopher. I wonder if they're having that pound cake over there. I go get the pound cake. I hear they have good catfish here. He loved catfish. So I'd go out and to get a plate of food. Now, Dr. King was a chick magnet. And all those ladies wanted to, you know, so like I go out and I get to get the plate, and the lady said, I take it to him. Give me the plate, lady. I ain't afraid to hit a woman. So like the thing was, everybody wanted to get in to see him. And it was just, but like it was my gig. It was my gig. Can't beat that.
We are at the Cambridge Forum, and we are listening to a program, Witness to History, with Jack Landrone, talking about travels to Mississippi during Freedom Summer.
I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the role of music in that summer. I know you had a wonderful confluence of the folk music revival and the black church tradition and the, you know, the passion of what was happening. So can you speak about what it was like to sing?
Singing is always the same thrill, but like what was different is that the people sang as a part of their lives. Now, and especially in urban areas, music is entertainment solely. Kids that I sometimes go into schools, they can't sing any of their songs through. Because there's the beatbox has to come in here, or the, you know, the, I mean, you just can't sing a song all the way without going, I love you, you beautiful. This is not a song, but in the, you don't like that music. Well, no. When you sing in the church, you sing at home. Your grandma, when she's making them flapjacks, she's with Jesus, whatever they sing, you know. And it was a thrill that I always insist on some to greater or lesser degrees, singing with people. Every time I appear someplace, at least one, two, three songs, I involve the audience. Sing with me. I think that when you music is, it transcends so much. And if I sing with you, we're doing something together that's wonderful. I like that, and I've always liked it, but I saw it living in the South.
Could you tell us how you were different when you came back from Mississippi from when you drove down there?
I'd had an experience that kids I went to school, many they didn't have. I knew something that they didn't know. I had a different view of the world. I had a different view of white people. I had a different view of the American government. I had a different view of many things that we are taught, and I had to sift it through my basic beliefs. I do not, and don't think I ever could, hate white people. But there is a distrust, and I learned it. I am not inferior. I am learning it because the insidiousness of prejudice is that on some level, those who are victims believe the bad things. Don't make me, now you're getting close to me, but it's hard to fight with yourself. To say, yeah, you know. And I learned that that's what I had to do.
I was 5 years old when all of that was happening.
Oh, rub it in. You're young.
No, not from that perspective. Because I was reared in Louisiana. As a person of color in that atmosphere, what just bogs my mind is that what you experienced and saw 50 years ago, I was seeing 3 months ago when I got laid off from my job. And it just saddens me that we haven't, the experience that y'all had 50 years ago, we really haven't gone and progressed very far.
You have to look, because on the face value, things haven't changed, and oh, there's still a struggle. And I think that they will be for a long time, but there have been some changes. There have been great changes. Even take Barack Obama, everybody, oh, well, it's all over now because you got a black president. Won't you people shut up? It has, that, you know, that doesn't change anything, it seems. But it is a change because there is a domino effect in life. This happens and this happens and this. Little kids are growing up more accustomed to seeing authority coming from people that might not look like them. Mm-hmm. Being able to, if they're lost, go up to a policeman and not be afraid that he's a black policeman and not make that distinct. You know, there are changes, and the human mind is so very complex, and it may look like, hey, I'm still in the same hole. You have to know where to look for the changes. I think they're there.
This will be our last question, but please go ahead.
I'm an African-American female. I'm 22.
And beautiful.
Thank you. And I'm wondering, as you can see around the room, I may be on the younger end, and we're not in high numbers.
Oh, another one. Yeah, you're young. So what?
I know. My point is, how do we engage and empower more young people to be a part of this conversation, both in interacting with this history and with those that have had very direct and intense experiences with segregation, Jim Crow, and racism? And how do we bring into the conversation the experiences that these young people are having right now?
The short answer is I don't really know. But I think that by being who you are, and I'm not being glib when I say, hey, you're beautiful, you're this or that. You are beautiful, and you're expressing an interest in something. And just by being you, I'm influenced by you, and people will be. It won't be any big influence like Dr. King had or Obama, or any, it's not going to be that. But you are an influence by not being afraid of being who you are. So keep showing up and don't back away from what you think and believe. Somebody's going to hear. When is it going to change? I don't know. I don't know if it's going to change before we blow the world up. But I think that you just, every little step, poco a poco se anda lejos. That's what my mother used to say. It means little by little you go far, but it's little by little. And you's a good-looking little, honey.
Thank you so much, Jack Landrone. I just have to remind everyone, you have been listening to a program at Cambridge Forum. For information about this forum entitled Witness to History, Remembering Freedom Summer, featuring Jack Landrone, visit us at cambridgeforum.org. In Harvard Square, I'm Millie Ron. Thanks for joining us.